This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, we have some good news here for one of our local authors. Carol J. Perry is really, really rocking the boat with her latest book in her Witch City Mysteries. And I am so happy to hear that she is climbing the charts on Amazon. She is going to be, her book is in Barnes & Noble, which is always a fantastic thing for an author. And I am so happy that she's going to be back here next Tuesday to talk about her experience at Sleuth Fest. She was a presenter this year, and so it's going to be really fascinating to hear her take on all of the authors that she met and all of the things that she learned while she was at Sleuth Fest. So that's going to be on Tuesday, and I'm always very happy to welcome Carol J. Perry back to Joy on Paper. You know, there are lots of things happening this month, and one of them is the Reader's Digest Book Awards for self-published authors is coming up in April, and I wanted to talk to somebody who knows something about it, because she is a fantastic author, and I am so impressed with her work. So I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Nancy Peacock. Nancy, are you there?
I am here. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it is so wonderful to talk to you again. First of all, it was funny. I was on your website, and it's not often that a writer gets to be in the National Enquirer.
No, I'm probably the only one.
I thought that was so cool. You get a lot of coverage, so when your book comes out, and of course we're going to be talking about your fantastic, fantastic book, it's so funny that when this, I looked at your webpage and I saw this article, because I hadn't seen it before, and I thought, oh, wow, this is good. and you look so beautiful there, and they have you all dolled up here for the article. And of course it's called Cleaning Lady is an Acclaimed Author. Oh, isn't that nice?
I was misquoted. I was disappointed. First of all, I was disappointed that they didn't take Raquel Welch's body and put my face on it. But they, let's see, I was quoted as having said, I'm just a regular gal who loves to write.
Uh-huh.
And I know I did not say that.
You didn't write, you're just a regular gal, huh?
Right, I wouldn't say that.
No. But it is interesting to see that, and I thought, well, if for no other reason, and there are many reasons that people should go to your webpage, because your blog is fascinating, but just to look at this picture, I think it's delightful.
Thank you.
So you have it framed and on the wall, and
I don't, but I did make lemonade out of that situation and wrote A Broom of One's Own.
Uh-huh.
And it grew from the fact that I was featured in the National Enquirer.
Well, it's I think it's lovely. And of course, what brings us here today, we're going to talk about, actually I want to talk about quite a few of your books, because you're a fascinating writer. I just, when I first came across your book, which of course, it's funny that the book that now you're famous for is called The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about the evolution of that, and then we'll go back and talk about some of your other books, because you are one of those writers who, when I am reading your work, I know that you are just thinking of every word, that you are trying to get it so right, so perfect, that we don't notice it. I mean, in the normal...
It's interesting you should say that, because one of the things I try and do as a fiction writer is disappear. You know, I want it to all be about the character in the story, and I don't want to be visible at all.
Exactly, and you do. I mean, on the first reading, I forgot what I was doing. I forgot everything, because it's just... flows so beautifully. Everything just, it's like, it's almost, I mean, it is magical. It's magical writing, because it's hard for a writer to so pull in a reader that they forget everything and they are with this character and they believe that they're, I mean, you almost feel you're right there. You're right, you know, well, let's talk about why we are right there in this wonderful book, because it all starts with this opening line.
I have been to hangings before, but never my own.
Wow. I mean, just that right there, you'd have to say, okay, she came on this sentence, and wow, the story just went wild.
You can't turn away a line like that.
No.
And that line came to me. It just came to me. It just arrived in my... in my head. I was getting up in the dark and walking to the top of a hill, which is about a 3-mile walk, and then I watched the sunrise and returned home. And watching the sunrise one day, it just, that line entered my head.
Wow.
And, you know, so things are given to you that way sometimes, if you can get quiet enough and still enough.
And this is in North Carolina.
This is in North Carolina, correct?
Which is, I was just talking to John Hart the other day, and I said, there's something in North Carolina that... turns out these writers, there's John Hart, Sharon McCrum, and of course Margaret Maron, and so many others. It's just, and Anne B. Ross. It's just, wow, you guys over there are really writing up a storm.
There are a lot of writers here. I live in Hillsborough, and there are a lot of writers in Hillsborough. Lee Smith, Jill McCorkle, Zelda Lockhart. I could go on. A.J. Mayhew, myself.
Okay,
Alan Gerganis.
So you were walking along one morning, and this just comes to you. It was meant to be, that's for sure.
Well, you know, this character, Persimmon Wilson, Percy is his nickname, was just such a great character to work with. You know, some characters, if a person doesn't write fiction, it's hard to understand, but some characters want to talk to you more than others, and he wanted to talk. He had a story to tell, and he was very willing to tell it through me, and I was very willing to listen. So it was it's a harsh book. It has a lot of it has more violence in it than I had ever written before, and certainly more historical research than I'd ever done before. But it was so interesting to write that I was always engaged with it.
And of course, as you said, there is a lot of research that went into this book.
Quite a bit of research.
So how did you go about it? Because one of the things that, you know, writers will ask me, they'll say, well, I have an idea for a story, but I don't know how to build it up. And I said, a lot of it does come through research, because it opens your mind to ideas. It sends you on different paths. As you're doing research, isn't it wonderful where you're looking up one thing and then it leads you to the next, something absolutely that you didn't think about.
Right. I love research for that very reason. It's just groping through things and paying attention to what you're actually reading, which is why I would never farm out my research to anyone if I had the money to do so, because I don't always know what I'm looking for. You know, I know I'm looking for, like, for instance, in this book, I was looking for the facts around the fall of New Orleans during the Civil War, and I was looking for facts around the Comanche Indians. But you end up with all this other little wonderful detail, depending on what you read, that's so interesting that you can layer in and make your story more real, and it is real, you know.
It takes on a life of its own, doesn't it?
It does.
And once you have a character as rich as Percy, I mean, wow, you have so much to work with there.
Yes, he was a great character, and I'm pretty random about research. I sort of start a book, and then I start doing the research. I don't do my research beforehand. I do my research as I'm writing, which means I'm kind of, it's sort of a zigzaggy pattern. It's not very straightforward, but it's the way that works for me, is to just sort of always be searching and as I'm writing and finding things and layering them in. I just found out recently on the book that I'm currently writing that there was a total solar eclipse on January 1st, 1889. And I think, oh, I mean, that's a great thing to know if you're writing about the year 1889.
It is, and it makes you think, wow, what did people think back then? They didn't know all the stuff we know about.
Well, they did. Actually, a lot of them knew, but a lot of them, you know, a lot of Native Americans maybe didn't know or did know but called it something else. I don't know what people thought. I mean, it was predicted in 1889.
So now with the story about Percy, tell the listeners more about how he got to where he was and fill us in on the story the way you like to tell it, because you are a natural storyteller.
Oh,
and that
you.
comes through with your you know, all of your writing. You tell
thank
us
you. The story opens, the first chapter opens in a little town called Drunken Bride, Texas, which is just a little fly speck of a town in 1875. And Percy is awaiting his execution. He's going to be hanged for the murder of his former master. He was an enslaved man. He was freed, and he ended up going to Texas in search of a woman he loved named Chloe, who also was tied in with the master, the man he killed. And he ends up riding with the Comanche Indians and killing his former master while he rides with the Comanche Indians. So he's about to hang for that. And, you know, it's interesting because in that first chapter, he just about tells everything. But you forget that, I hope, and you want to know, how did this happen? So he was enslaved on a sugar plantation in Louisiana. New Orleans fell. His master, the man who owned all these slaves, abandoned his plantation and took his slaves with him to Texas, as a lot of men did, because they were, quote-unquote, protecting their property. But he left Percy behind. And then Percy, after the Civil War, goes off in search of Chloe.
And there is the story. And it's his travels and all of the things that happens to him along the way.
And his love for Chloe. His love for Chloe is the driving force of this book.
It is. It's a love story.
It is a love story.
And such
and
a
an touch, adventure story.
Exactly, because I thought the part, of course, of when he joins the Comanches and all of this is fascinating history.
It is. I got very interested in this period just after the Civil War. Very interested in what happened to the Comanche during that time, because after the Civil War was over, the army sort of turned its attention to the West and to Manifest Destiny and to subjugating the Indians. So that's when that pressure started happening. You know, during the Civil War, a lot of the Indians the Native Americans were pretty much left alone, because the South and the North were busy fighting each other.
And then, of course, things changed as many of the Southerners actually did flee to the West.
Right.
And got involved in more adventures with the Indians too. So, or Native Americans. It's hard. Sometimes we forget, you know. But you've really told a fascinating story here, because there were many things. I always love a book where I don't know, you know, where I learned something. And so that's, I found that was very true in this book. I lived in Texas for quite a while. So I'm very aware of the cowboys, black cowboys in Texas are very proud and wonderful people, and it was always wonderful to see them and to see their pride in their part of you know, working in Texas in those days. But of course, then there is this element of what happened to the Native Americans in Texas too. So, but it's all sort of part of the framework of your story that you bring in all of these different elements.
Well, in the framework of America, I mean, we have a very complex history that it's complex. I mean, there's a lot to explore about how we've related to each other throughout these years. And it's important to know.
It is. And I think that knowing Percy, I think one feels better for knowing Percy.
Oh, well, nice. Thank you.
I felt, wow, I'm so glad that I got to know him for a little while and that I got to understand him and really to appreciate a man who would be so in love with a woman that he went through all that he went through just because of this love. And I thought that's you accomplished something wonderful there.
Well, and you know, he's in the beginning, I mean, he is a flawed character. In the beginning, he is Chloe wants him to plot an escape with her from Sweetmore, which is the name of the sugar plantation they're working on. She's a house slave and he is a field slave, and he's hesitant to do so, and he lies to her and says that he's making up a pass and he's got a plan and all this, that, and the other, and really he's just taking comfort from her, and she comes to realize that. And so he grows, he develops in this book quite a bit, I'd say.
Oh, absolutely. Now, how long did it take for you to write this book?
It took me 2 years.
2 years. And now, as you said, you jump in and start writing. When you finished your first draft, you sat back and you said, whew, this is a pretty great book.
I finished my first draft. I started my second draft. Pretty much the way it goes.
That's the way. Now, of course, The fascinating thing about this book is that you did self-publish this book.
I did. I self-published in 2013, and it won in 2013 the Shelf Unbound contest for best self-published book, and then in 2015 it won the Writer's Digest best self-published book in mainstream fiction. Well, so it did pretty well as a self-published book.
It did very well, and one of the things that's happening this month is April 2nd is the deadline for self-published books for this year's Writer's Digest mm-hmm. contest. And I think with what happened to you, that you were self-published, you won awards, and those awards got you noticed. And noticed big time, because when you were picked up by Atria, who republished the book. Now, were there any changes in the book from the time that the first version to the second version?
Yes, not many.
Not many.
One chapter is significantly changed, and that's the chapter in which he's wandering around in Texas searching for Chloe. And the reason that changed is because I did more research and really found out that Texas during the Reconstruction period would not be a safe place for him at all, and he had to be much more careful about his travels, and he had to sort of have a network of black people to you know where to go next, where was safe, where wasn't safe. It was dangerous.
Well, I think from a indie writer's perspective, you are like, it is so wonderful. You're sort of the Cinderella of indie writers, because most indie writers they do self-publish, and I have discovered now as I've been doing this program that they'll self-publish, and they really they're new to the world of publishing, mm-hmm. and they don't know to make that next step that you started winning prizes, and that got you noticed, and that was very, very important.
First of all, I want to say I had a great time being self-published. It was wonderful. And it's just really hard, because distribution is the big question with self-publishing. You know, how's it going to get to the bookstores? Now, Or how not even how is it going to get there, because Ingram will distribute it. Anybody could buy my book, or any bookstore could buy my book. It's more like, how do you convince them that they should buy your book? And you're just one writer, so, you know, traditional publishers have salespeople going out, sales reps, and saying, here's what's available. And it's understandable that bookstores are hesitant to carry a lot of independently published books.
Because they...
They have limited resources.
Exactly. You know? It's hard for them to lose money, and hard for them to return the books if they don't sell. Now, in your case, of course, it's lucky, but you deserve that luck, because this is really quite a brilliant book. And as I have told my listeners, the Writer's Digest contests are really the top of the line contests. If you win there, you do get noticed, and you certainly got noticed in a big way, because Atria, they did a production of your book, a hardback, that is top quality.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is. I was so, I get a lot of books, and the publishers publish nice books, but when I got this book, and I said, wow, they sunk some money into this book.
I love the map on the inside. I just love it.
Everything. It's just such a top-notch production. Just the production value alone, that you'd love to hold this book. The cover's great. The paper's wonderful. And, of course, your writing is fantastic. But it's so wonderful that it got out there in sort of the mainstream of the book world. It's amazing.
One of the things I love about the cover of the Atreus book is it's got this button on it, which is significant to the story, and it's embossed.
I know.
So you can feel it.
I know. I kept rubbing my finger over it. I said, whoa, they like this author. When I got the book, before I even opened it, I said, oh, they like this author. They don't do that. They don't do that for everybody.
No, they don't.
I mean, they really don't. People will sort of, I've mentioned it to some people, they sort of, what? I say, yeah, that costs more money. You have to understand that a little bit of embossing adds a penny or two, to the cover. And they don't do it, even for really big names. So I was so impressed with it. And
well,
I said,
it's so great that button is very significant. It's a button that belonged to Chloe that Percy found, and he puts it on a strand of leather and wears it around his neck all his life and all the rest of his life. And he, throughout the book, he's sort of fingering the button and thinking about Chloe here and there. And it meant a lot to me that they embossed it like that.
And
it meant a lot to Percy.
And I think it means a lot also to readers who are in the know.
Uh-huh.
Because even if I just saw it on a shelf, and I, I'm walking along and they have it piled up on the table in Barnes & Noble or something, and I saw that embossing, I'd say to myself right away, okay, they know something about this author. This is a really great author. And so I was so, so thrilled with that. And it's also, as I said, it gives hope to indie authors that yes, there can be a second life to your book.
Right, there can be, and there should be. there's a lot of books published. I think there's like 3,000 books published a day or something, and that includes indie authors. And that's a tremendous amount. It's very difficult to get noticed.
It is.
In the midst of all that.
It is. And, that's why I love to do this program, because I sort of revisit books, even for you. Right now, you're not getting a lot of coverage, for this book. They're waiting for the next book. But I say, this is a book that people should read, and I want them to read it, so I want them to hear about you. And I have a few other indie authors whose book they've published, on their own. And they have not, and I am encouraging them to do what you did. Enter it into contests, get noticed, and hopefully, and there's one particular book that I absolutely love. I think it's a fantastic book. The author self-published it. And I want somebody to pick it up because it is a wonderful, wonderful book. And it deserves to be, you know, have this wide distribution that, that only one of the major publishing houses can do.
Right.
So, look, I have to take a commercial break, but when I come back, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you about your other books, Life Without Water, which I think is fascinating, and also your book about house cleaning, because I love that book. I love that book. And about your jobs. You know, I've had a lot of the same jobs as you have. So we'll be right back, okay?
All right.
Hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543. Love a good book? Then the Book Swap of Curewood is the place for you. They carry both new and used books. Looking for a cozy mystery, books for the kids, or a great thriller? They've got it all. So head over to the Book Swap of Curewood, located at 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Valentine's Day is coming soon. Stop in and meet the friendly staff who will help you find the perfect gift. Remember, 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Book Swap of Curewood has been part of the North Tampa community since 1984.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Nancy Peacock, the author of Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, an absolutely fantastic book, and I am so happy to have you on the program today, Nancy.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, yeah, I was telling in the first part of the program, I mentioned your website, which is nancypeacockbooks.com. And I mention it again because I want people to go there. One, they can see this lovely photo of you in the National Enquirer, which not every author gets to be. And then I also, I love your list. You're the only author I know who has ever put a list of their jobs, of all the jobs that they've had. And so I had fun. I was going through the list and I was, you know, checking off which ones I've had the same jobs as you. You've had a lot of jobs.
I've had a lot of jobs, yep.
But isn't it wonderful, actually, for a writer to have had a lot of jobs? It gives you dimension.
It does. It's been very beneficial to my writing to have had a lot of those jobs, to have had all of them. Now, well, at the time, it would have been difficult for me to say that.
Yeah.
But I understand that now because I've drawn off my jobs. I've drawn off my experiences. I know what it is to, you know, to work with my hands, to work hard, to do physical labor. My jobs are along the lines of house cleaning, Forstalmucker.
Oh, I love
newspaper delivery. You know,
I love that one. Now, newspaper delivery. I started my newspaper route when I was 7.
Oh wow!
And I just had so much fun doing that. I love that. I lived in a small town in the Upper Peninsula. It's called Barraga. It's a very little town. And it was so wonderful. Why I love that job, because I was, you know, going around on my bike and delivering. But what I loved is Fridays when I went to collect the money.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And we had 3 bars in Barraga. And so I still love the smell of beer because I just love to walk into those bars. I deliver the paper and I, you know, give the bill, and I was supposed to get whatever it was, like, you know, whatever the weekly rate was. But everybody in the bar would give me an extra quarter. So I'd walk out of these 3 bars at the age of 7 with tons of money.
That's awesome.
It was fun. They knew Patsy was coming, and it was, I loved it. So I made a little fortune there as a newspaper delivery person. But it was fun.
Well, no wonder you still like the smell of beer.
Oh, I do. it thrills me. I love to just walk in to a bar like that just to smell the beer, because, I mean, I don't think I've ever had a glass of beer. I just love the smell of it.
That's funny.
But, of course, now, the one job that I really like that you put, and I thought it was really, really cute, because you... were a stall mucker.
I was a stall mucker.
And I like that you put it in capital, you know, stall mucker with a capital M, because because I thought it made it very professional sounding, rather like an attorney at law. It deserves a capital M. A job like that, just like an attorney, you deal with a lot of crap.
True.
And I thought, I like this girl. She makes it a capital M. So, and I did the same, but not for horses. My grandfather had a farm, and once in a while I did that. Mostly I fed the chickens. I love feeding chickens. It's a wonderful thing. There's something very satisfying about feeding chickens, I think.
Well, they're very responsive.
They are. They are.
Right.
They appreciate it right there. You feed them, and they're saying thank you right away.
So, I milked cows for a while.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that was a tough job. But, you know, educational. Everything you do is educational.
Yeah, because then when you're writing about somebody being in the field, you actually know what it feels like.
Right. And not just making it up.
Yeah. I mean, so many writers, let's put it this way, today, I mean, they go through school and they have their little, you know, cliques and their little adventures in school. Then they go to college and they have their little sorority adventures. And then, and their biggest challenge in life is shopping. And then they start writing books. But they have really limited experience. And you notice that after a while, authors who have really not lived. And you certainly have lived, let's put it that way.
I have lived. and I've worked.
And you have worked. And you have worked hard. And that brings us to your book about house cleaning, which I love this book, because here's what happens to me. When I go to a hotel, having done many jobs, house cleaning, babysitting, when I go to stay in a hotel, I always fold the towels, the dirty towels, and put them on the side of the bathtub, because mm-hmm. I always feel bad for the girl to have to bend over all the time to pick up a bunch of icky, messed up towels.
I'm sure that's the more pleasant experience that they could describe. I mean, I'm sure there are worse experiences.
There are worse. I mean, I actually cleaned the bathroom before in a hotel when my kids are always teasing me, Mom, it's a hotel. I said, I don't care. You fold your towels, you pick them up, you don't leave soggy messes on the floor.
There are people on the other end of that.
Yeah, you don't
there
leave.
There are people, and they are people that matter.
Yeah, and it's not fair to just leave a big, just because you're in a hotel. I'm going to be a slob here. No. That's not the way, because you know it's not nice. It's hard enough work to clean, to be a cleaner, that yes. At least people can be responsible and do part of the work for, you know, beforehand, right?
I agree with that.
And so let's talk about, you know, this book, and not, I don't, I think it's also one of the, it's very unusual, let's put it this way, for somebody to write about their life as a house cleaner.
It's titled A Broom of One's Own, playing off of A Room of One's Own.
Yeah.
because, you know, house cleaning and my broom are really what got me, I mean, they supported me for years while I was writing. So I didn't have a room of my own. I did have a broom of my own.
but the book is rich with stories. I mean, in many cases, you can take the actual, those stories and then turn those stories into a book by itself.
You probably could,
you know,
if you were so inclined.
Because you had some adventures as a house cleaner.
Well, you get to know people. I mean, this is something people should know when you're hire a house cleaner. That person, it's an intimate job. They know things about you. I'm not saying people snoop necessarily, but it's very easy to know something about the person whose house you're cleaning. Just from their habits, just from what they leave laying around, just from your interaction with them. So it's an intimate job, and you get to know the people you're cleaning for, and you get to know some of their stories, and even if they're not there. And a lot of times the people were not there when I was cleaning. I preferred it that way. So what was good about it for me was that I was alone, and I could sort of think about my writing. I would write in the morning. I would go clean a house. And, you know, there's that just physical movement, and I know you're supposed to be mindful of everything you're doing, but you don't really want to be mindful when you're cleaning a house that much. You know, you want to give your subconscious time to kick in, and that's a lot of what happened.
And it is true that while you're cleaning, your mind does wander onto other things, and that's exactly what you want when you have all these story ideas percolating in your head.
Well, and I was cleaning houses when I wrote my first novel, Life Without Water. And I remember really taking advantage of that situation, and I'd write in the morning, and I may hit some thorny little place in the narrative where I didn't quite know what to do, and I'd put it in my mind and say, okay, I'm just going to let this be in my mind while I'm working today. I wouldn't necessarily think about it actively, but I would have it in my mind. And oftentimes, you know, I had a solution by the end of the day the next morning when I sat down to write.
And Life Without Water is a very interesting book. It's told in the first person, and it's about a girl who has to come to terms with life and the life that she's given. Tell us a little bit about that, because one of the things is last week I interviewed Kristen Hanna, and she wrote a book called The Great Alone, which is also a book about a young girl coming of age with a sort of a hippie family that's taken her off into a middle of nowhere in Alaska.
She has to
deal with a lot of family problems, abuse, her father is abusive, and there she is in, you know, in this sort of hippie mindset of her parents, but she has to deal with real life and in many ways become the adult of the group. So tell us a little bit about Cedar is the name of the girl in Life Without Water. Tell us about it.
Cedar is and it's narrated in Cedar's voice, first person. Cedar is a young girl who was born to a woman, hippie parents, and then her mother left her father, who was sort of no good, not really helping out very much. They lived in this house that didn't have plumbing, And she traveled across the country, met somebody else, came back, and the theater basically grew up on a commune. So the way that grew for me was the fascination in, I grew up in the 60s, I came of age in the 60s, but, and I noticed, you know, a lot of people my age had kids, and they probably shouldn't have, but they did, and those children were having a very different childhood experience than what I had. And I just became very interested in that. What was that like for them? And Cedar truly becomes her mother's advocate. Her mother has a lot of wounds. She's not an abusive person. She's a tender, good person, but she's not always present for Cedar in the way that one would hope she could be. But this is another thing I learned in writing this book. You know, in the commune, Cedar's mother sort of falls apart over an incident, and the other people in the commune sort of pick up the slack of raising Cedar. There's some other kids in the commune. So there were adults there who were taking care of her. And I thought, well, that's sort of like the extended family used to be, you know? It used to be a mother had a little more room to go to bed, you know, if she wasn't feeling well, because maybe the grandmother was there to pick up the slack.
Well, as I said, when I was reading Kristen Hannah's book, The Great Alone, there was, you know, similar themes. There was the problem of a Vietnam vet and all the struggles that, you know, were involved with those men who came back and had so many problems, and then of course with a girl having to take on responsibilities at a very young age, and
right.
and be the adult in the or at least to be the strong one, and so I think that's a very moving book too.
And I'm going to look for that book. You know, it's a fascinating era to write about, and there was a lot of turmoil. There were a lot of things going on in the 60s. You know, there was communes, back to the land. There was the political movement. There were the Weather Underground people who were bombing buildings. There was a lot of radical stuff. There were draft dodgers going up into Canada. There were people who were going to jail because they wouldn't go serve in Vietnam. There was all kinds of stuff going on. Women's movement, all these other political things were coming up. It's a very interesting time to write about, and complex, like most of American history. And I focused sort of on the commune, Vietnam, back to the land part of it. I think a lot of those groups were isolated from each other.
And that's what Kristen Hannah's book is similar in that, because they want to get away from everything and just be, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And of course, in that case, it was being in the middle of nowhere in Alaska, which is a challenge in itself.
Right.
You don't want to be in the middle of nowhere in Alaska in the wintertime.
You really know what you're doing.
You got it. And so that's a fascinating book. And I think Life Without Water is a fascinating book. And what's happening now with you? What's the new book is almost done, halfway done. It takes you a while. You're not one of these people who just turns them out every 6 months.
Oh, you noticed that.
Yeah, I did. Well, and I was thinking, that's refreshing, because
<Thank you.
laughs> really, I wonder if Leo Tolstoy was told, I want a book a year from you guys.
I can't do it.
It's hard.
I can't do it and be pleased with what I would turn out. You know, there's a difference between writing and typing. And I'm not saying, you know, everybody who turns out a book in a year is just typing, because people work differently. But I work very slowly. And I have to have a little space between one book and the next, partly because that character has possessed me so much and so intensely and so thoroughly that the character of the book I've just finished hasn't really cleared out of my system yet. You know, I need a little space for that opening to happen, for the next character to step in.
Well, of course, it's nice now that you had the success of, you know, this big success here with The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, which, you know, we can, I hate always to say that I hope it made into a film, but one of the one of the things I love books just to stand on their own, but it does help an author, because this is the problem that authors need this ongoing publicity and ongoing opportunity to talk about their work, because if people don't hear about your books, the chances are that, you know, it might be by accident that they pick it up, but you need that both word of mouth and an opportunity to talk about your work and make people interested. And I think people should be interested in you as a writer. You've developed, you're getting better. You know, that's the nice thing about being able to, in this age of internet, that you can go back and get people's books and see their first book, and then you see them getting better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The evolution, right?
Yeah, I love
I would love for this book to be made into a movie. For one thing, it's cinematic in and of itself, it's epic. So I think it would make a great movie.
Well, you know, I used to write screenplays and scripts, and I, when I see a book, when I read a book and I see it as a film, which I did with this one. I mean, I saw from the opening sentence as I started reading it, and I'm already, I mean, I'm ready. They, in a minute, I would have taken the job on of turning this book into a script, because I saw the entire book as a film in my head. And I, it doesn't happen with every book I read. I was reading a book by Douglas Brunt called The Ghosts of Manhattan, and I started reading that book, and within maybe three paragraphs, I started to see a scene, and it wasn't a scene that was in that particular book. That book, he had not written it actually out. He had not written it out, but I saw the main character dancing down the streets of Manhattan, and I said, well, you know, where is this coming from? But there was something about the character that I knew this guy would be joyous. I knew that he would... He wouldn't just walk down the stairs. I mean,
of embedded in the voice,
and there was something, and I said, "Wow, this is a movie." And for the rest of the book, it was a movie in my head. Mm-hmm. And the same happened with this. You know, I'm saying this is a movie. This is ready to go. I'm like,
oh, well, if you still got any contacts in Hollywood,
well, you know,
give it to them.
This is what I want to do. I want people to notice these books that are we really need some books that are done well in Hollywood. Please, Hollywood, please, because this story has so many possibilities. If you're looking for a part for somebody to win an Academy Award, you've got characters in here, the main character and the other characters who, those are like what in Hollywood we'd call juicy parts. I mean, those would be fantastic. I would in an instant, I would in a month be able to write a screenplay where somebody could take this on and make a big hit out of it. So I'm hoping for you.
Thank you.
Because
I appreciate that.
Because and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you back on. And also I wanted to make sure that I remind everybody that the Writer's Digest contest, it's worthwhile, isn't it?
It is worthwhile. Very worthwhile.
And not only do you win $8,000 this year, so that's the prize, and you get noticed, and that's the most important thing.
Well, you know, you also get a lot of books. They give you, I think, I forget how many, you know, they give you a number of, you can go shopping. They give you a little gift certificate through the Writer's Digest store, and that was fun.
That was fun. That alone is worth it. Just to, well, you know, I know the feeling. I come in the studio today, and I've got a pile of books waiting for me. I love to get books.
And very so, exciting.
Nancy, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much for having me, Pat.
Joy to talk to you, and it's nancypeacockbooks.com. People should go there and look at Nancy's photo. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Nancy. It was great talking to you. Okay. Well, I hope all of you authors here in our local area or wherever you are, I don't care if you're in Detroit or Miami or Phoenix or wherever you are, if you've published a book, self-published, you can enter it into the Writer's Digest contest until April 2nd. And Nancy's a testament to what can happen, because then she turns her book into a major, major production, and it's really wonderful. So, and that's available at, the contest rules are on writersdigest.com. Go there under competitions and enter today, because you never know. Your self-published book might be picked up by a major publisher, republished as Nancy's was in a very beautiful production. And next thing you know, you'll be on the bookshelves all over America, like Carol J. Perry. And meanwhile, remember to, one of the greatest things in life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. And Nancy, as a matter of fact, has a nice audible book also of this. Or someday to see them on the big screen. And so it's up to you. You have 365 days in a year. And start writing. And meanwhile, go to my webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. And you can listen to the archives of my interviews. And like me on Facebook. And on Radio Joy on Paper, and follow me on Twitter. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he's always so nice to me, and he gets everything done, and he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, because I like to be saluted. Okay, go get Nancy's book. You will really enjoy it. Bye-bye now.